Yeah, please, the court, I'm T.R. Rice, registration number 13436, representing the festival, which I think in the briefs is referred to from time to time as the CRF or the festival. The record in this case shows that there's no question that at all times Parsons was an independent contractor of the town of Larkspur or the town, and it was free from all control of the town. There's also no question that it was Parsons that authored the demand letter in February of 2003 that started the firefight, if you will. And with that factual backdrop, when this case went up to the Supreme Court previously, the Supreme Court at page 1069 of its decision noted as follows with respect to Parsons and not to the town. First, that Parsons was hired to diagnose and resolve the problems with the infrastructure in the town. Second, that it was Parsons and not the town that concluded that the festival was using more wastewater than it had been allotted by virtue of the tap fees assessed. That this analysis of Parsons and not the town was flawed. And that based upon that flawed analysis, the town authorized the demand letter which Parsons authored and which the mayor actually thought that Parsons had signed. And as it turns out, that the analysis that was relied upon on the town to even move forward was deficient in any number of ways, including mistaken assumptions and relying on what the trial court in the first case referred to as incredible data. Now, notwithstanding that, the trial court here, being Judge King in the second case, came to the conclusion that the sole reason for the litigation and the sole reason that the festival prevailed in the prior case was because of the town's misapplication or misinterpretation of Ordinance 5.23 and the analysis of do we use peak day or average day in order to assess additional EQRs.
Can I ask you, Mr. Rice, did the court really say that it was the sole basis? I mean, my understanding of the court's decision was because it was a basis, there was no, you couldn't prove causation.
Your Honor, that's not the way that I read his order. I think his order says the Judge Curry found that the determination of the town to try to assess additional EQRs was predicated upon a misinterpretation of the ordinance, and therefore this court, meaning Judge King, didn't need to hear any other facts.
Because you can't prove causation because that's what caused the injury, and therefore the rest of it becomes irrelevant.
Exactly.
Okay. Exactly. Let me ask another question then following up on that, and I'll just tell you that the issue, I'm a little confused with all due respect to my friends upstairs, what exactly they meant in the Supreme Court's opinion. And I'm really kind of stuck on this language about uniquely traceable. And so perhaps you can help me out with this. What your interpretation, what you think that means? Because one could read this language about uniquely traceable, I think you're tracking with me, that they said that and your colleagues here say the standard is whether your injuries were uniquely traceable to the defendant's conduct. Here, one could argue there are two causes. One is the defendant's conduct. They messed up their calculations, right. Blah, blah, blah. And the second is, and then the town took its interpretation. And both of those things, you know, operated together. If that's right, and it might be wrong, then how would it be uniquely traceable to their conduct? Could you address what you think uniquely traceable means, and then
sure.
tell me how you resolve that? Because I don't think you could say here that the defendant's actions were the sole cause, because the town could have said, yeah, that's all well and good, but we don't have a leg to stand on our interpretation of the ordinance.
I think that the term uniquely traceable relates more to the actions of particular defendants or potential defendants, which, if you will, put the ball in motion that caused a litigant such as the festival to incur attorney's fees. I don't think that uniquely traceable means by any stretch of the imagination who the participants were. So in this instance, uniquely traceable would relate to number one, Does it pertain to the wastewater system? And number two, what role did Parsons have, if any, in coming up with the analysis, which then resulted in the town's need or the town's desire to interpret Ordinance 5.23 in the manner that it did?
Let me make sure I understood what you just said.
Sure.
So your suggestion here is that uniquely traceable really ties back to the distinction between water services generally and the wastewater. And here it's uniquely traceable because we're just talking about the wastewater.
Exactly.
All right.
And Judge, if you want to take it a step further, I don't think that uniquely traceable is meant to circumvent or create a standard that's above and beyond the significant factor standard in a typical case like this. I mean, if you're a significant factor and you cause harm, you're negligent. So I don't think that the Supreme Court at all meant to supplant that standard in a wrong of another case, but rather they're saying, look, you got a whole bunch of stuff that you're saying is wrong. Okay? You need to be able to go back and say that your fees and your costs associated with the wastewater issue can be tied into the wrongful conduct in this instance of Parsons. And I don't think there's another way that the court's opinion can be read. You know, otherwise it would turn the law as we know it basically upside down. So I guess the law is clear on a couple of points that are germane here is that, first of all, the law doesn't require for a claimant in a wrong of another case who prevailed in the earlier case, which certainly is suggestive of the fact that there can be a differing basis for finding liability in the prior case and in the later case, which is certainly the case here in the context of Judge Curry's opinion, which I think was the path of least resistance, saying, look, even if all your facts are right, your interpretation of the ordinance is wrong. Now, in this case, he also found that the facts were wrong.
Pardon me for interrupting.
Yes.
Mr. Rice, if I may, please. We're at the summary judgment stage here, so obviously we've got summary judgment rules.
Right.
If this had been the trial, if we had been past summary judgment and the trial court had come out with this decision after there had been a trial and both sides had presented evidence, it certainly is possible that we would affirm the trial court's decision that, well, the town's decision was based on the ordinance, right?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. No, I mean, if the facts supported Judge Curry's order, and if the finder of fact concluded that there was no that Parsons was not a significant factor, okay, what we really have here is a situation by analogy is Parsons sold the gun, it put the bullets in the gun. And then the town pulled the trigger. I mean, it's very clear from the record that the town was relying heavily, if not solely, upon Parsons to determine, and this goes to Judge Curry's order, he determined that part of Ordinance 5.23 was ambiguous. He didn't say the entirety of the ordinance was ambiguous. And I touch on this in our opening brief, and it's this. In order for the town to get to the point of having to interpret the ambiguous part of Ordinance 5.23, within Parsons' sole ambit was a determination of whether or not the threshold had been met in order for the town to even consider that. And it's professional judgment. Is there a need for new facilities or expanded facilities? Is the festival a new user in the context of engineering? And is that new use something that is going to cause the town to expand its existing facilities such that additional tap fees need to be assessed in order to defray those costs? So in order to get to the end game, okay, the town was solely relying upon Parsons to say, we've crossed this threshold. We've satisfied what Krupp requires of us. You need to expand the existing facilities, and now you need to find a way to pay for it, and we've concluded that the festival is a new user, therefore you can assess additional EQRs. Now, the notion of peak day versus average day doesn't go to the fact that that additional EQRs need to be assessed, but rather it goes to the basis for quantifying the number of additional EQRs. So you don't get to quantity until Parsons had concluded that there was the need. And there's nothing in the record that would suggest that that portion of Ordinance 5.23 was ambiguous at all. Was there an intervening cause? Well, an intervening cause has to be unforeseeable. And I don't think that anybody in this room would argue that Parsons was unaware of the fact that the town was heavily reliant upon its advice in order to move forward in this consideration. And an intervening cause cannot be based upon the simple negligence of another party. And in this instance, the town was applying its interpretation of the law, that's the interpretation of Ordinance 5.23, based upon a series of admittedly erroneous facts, which brought them to the point where they said, okay, is it peak day or is it average day?
So
based on these facts, we need to consider.
Pardon me, Mr. Rice.
Yes, sir.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but is it your argument that the town's, that there were, for the basis of summary judgment, there were facts in the record to indicate that the town could have relied on what the Parsons engineering firm, the information it provided, in reaching its legal interpretation?
Yes, Your Honor, that's throughout the record. So I guess I'm, you know, from the time that Judge King reached his decision, I was kind of left scratching my head saying, it's clear from the record that Parsons did A, they made an error when they did A. It's clear from the record that the town was solely reliant upon Parsons to come up with this body of facts upon which to decide how they're going to quantify the EQRs that they'd like to assess. And I mean, I can't even begin to ask a question in terms of providing me an answer. So I'm certainly open to any questions from this panel in terms of what am I missing here? The court's opinion seems to be so divergent from the law as we understand it that I can't fathom.
Well, let me help you. I think it seems to me we've got two ships passing in the night here, and your briefs reflect that. I think my interpretation of the court, and my interpretation is as good as yours, of the court's ruling is that the courts, I think the court didn't need to, your argument here is they put this in motion. If they didn't make all these mistakes, the town never would have come after you. That's your position, and you say a reasonable jury could find from that they caused us to get involved in this litigation, your friends across the table. I think what the trial court said was, that's all well and good, but if they didn't the town didn't misinterpret its own ordinance, there never would have been a lawsuit in the first place. And therefore, I guess maybe that's an intervening cause issue, but I think that's where the ships are passing in the night. But your argument is, it's enough, a reasonable jury could find here, causation, that their mistakes caused you to get involved in litigation because but for their mistakes, the town never would have, you know, sought to impose those extra fees.
And to take it a step further, the town never would have considered whether it's peak day versus average day because they would have been provided with an accurate set of facts to demonstrate that the flows from the festival did not create a situation where the festival was A, new user, and B, certainly not a new user such that in addition to the existing facilities was required such that the town could even consider the fact that additional EQRs might be appropriate. And again, we've got fact versus quantity. It's the town's quantity that was an error, but it's the Parsons fact to get to that which was insubstantial error. I guess I'll reserve my 23 seconds for rebuttal unless there's other questions.
Thank you, counsel. Um, pardon me, before you get started, please, I'd just like, in light of a phone just going off, I'd like to repeat for anyone who has come into the courtroom since we had our first advisement that if you do have a phone or a pager that might go off and interrupt counsel, please either turn it off or put it on silent. Thank you very much. I'm sorry. Please proceed.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'm Kirk Mueller, registration number 16746 on behalf of the Appellees, Parsons, and Jim Miller, joined by my colleague, Damian Aguayo, at council table. Your Honors, an observation at the outset that might explain some of the ships passing in the night and might help clarify, this is a complicated case. This case started out as six claims 5 years ago, all of which, save one, have gone away on dispositive motions. As a consequence, every time we appear to argue about it, we're accepting all of the facts alleged by the festival as though they're true. Recognize that there is nothing clear from this record in terms of things like who authored and signed the letter, or who was right or wrong about 79,000 gallons and things like that. We're accepting that, but I want you, I know you understand this, but I don't want you to think there's some misjustice here that's gone unresolved. This is a case that is a unique kind of creature that's wrong of another tort that the Supreme Court has now clarified. And this is
pardon me, Mr. Mueller, but it's not a standalone tort at all, is it?
No, it's a doctrine.
Okay.
I apologize.
Yeah.
Don't ask me to explain the difference because I can't.
Thank you, sir.
This is a unique example of a wrong of another case, because in a classic wrong of another case, there are two different theaters going on. One is a third party has injured the plaintiff and caused him to engage separately in litigation with other parties. The classic example is the case of Fender versus Elijah. It's part of the jurisprudence in Colorado. It's cited in the festival's brief. In that case, the real estate agent takes a secret security interest in property that his client is buying. The client then has to engage in quiet title action to try to clear up his title. He goes back and sues the realtor and says, you know, you breached your fiduciary duty. So the two things happen. There's the litigation of quiet title on the one side and the litigation about breach of fiduciary duty on the other side. This case is different because what Parsons allegedly did wrong is the same thing that the town allegedly did wrong.
I guess I don't understand that argument, Mr. Mueller. Let me stop you. With all due respect and candor, that's why we're here. I'm really having trouble understanding your argument whole issue. Let me ask you my question. I'll tell you my question, and then you can get to it in your course. It seems to me, as you phrased it, the issue here is whether your client's negligence resulted in this other litigation. I think the festival's argument is pretty simple. It's if they didn't make all these mistakes, which the trial court did find, there's a lot of mistakes that got made, there never would have been this litigation. And my question is, why isn't that enough to get you to the jury in a case like this? Why isn't that the wrong of another? And my last question, and then I'll shut up, is I don't understand why it matters or why the issue turns on, you know, the misinterpretation. I can't capture that.
Okay, I'll try to address all of those. I will, and there you're focused right where you should be.
Thank you,
Your Honor. The reason is that all of the alleged negligence that Parsons engaged in was the subject, in this case, of the underlying litigation.
But how was it, again, forgive me for interrupting, but I mean this as a discussion, I hope you recognize
it's
not an interrogation. The court said, I don't have to reach those questions, and this will get you down to your collateral estoppel argument. The court said, I don't have to get there. I mean, the court never ruled on the question of whether Parsons was negligent or not. I mean, it just said, I don't have to get there because the misinterpretation was the cause.
Okay, well, and I think that's accurate and defensible. The only reason the festival can be heard to complain at all about anything in that case is because they were right on one issue. They were right about wastewater. Had they been wrong, had Judge Curry said, look, you really do owe money to the town, they couldn't complain. But Judge Curry said, in fact, you don't owe money to the town because, you know, they're wrong in their interpretation of their own ordinance, so they can't assess this. So their damage flows from the fact that they were right on the wastewater issue. But the reason they were right, according to Judge Curry, is the legal interpretation of an ambiguous ordinance, and not because of any of the engineering issues that were disputed and were the subject of the underlying lawsuit, but which Judge Curry characterized as academic. He discussed in passing but didn't rule on most of them. On one, he said, gee, I'm not sure I trust that number, it's incredible. On another issue, he said, you know, this could go either way. But then he said, they're all academic. none of them are of, you know, to quote Judge Curry, they don't bear on the real question here, whether or not the ordinance allows you to do this.
But why not? Why is it? Why couldn't a reasonable jury conclude that, but for all these mistakes, which you know your client was hired to advise the town, but for the mistakes, the town never would have done anything? Why couldn't a I recognize you disagree with that.
Okay.
Here to high heaven, and you may win that at a trial if we reverse. But why couldn't a reasonable jury say, but for the town's errors, we never would have had this other litigation?
Okay. There would have had been errors, wouldn't there? Okay. And this gets back to my opening statement in which the alleged errors that are attributed to Parsons were the exact issues that were litigated completely for 3 years. Brief evidence was heard, argument was presented on all of these engineering issues. There were competing engineering experts. They all fought about this, okay? They fought about 79,000 gallons. They fought about crop. The lawyers wrote briefs and briefs about crop, okay? That was what the litigation was about. At the end, Judge Curry decided it based on other issues. But let's go to your question. When it was all over, the festival files and grievances, we ought to have our fees. These engineering opinions were so wrong that they violate Rule 11. And the town came back and said, no, you violate Rule 11. There were 45 pages of briefs. Judge Curry considered whether either side had violated Rule 11. He rejected both sides' arguments. He presided over this case for 3 years, 45 pages of argument about whether either side was wrong, and he determined at the end that neither side had acted wrongfully.
But isn't there a difference between, well, with the court, and it was a Rule 11 motion, as you say.
Correct.
The court's finding, essentially, neither side was frivolous. Isn't that a different standard than whether you cause someone to incur fees, which they're asserting as damages?
Footnote 9 in my brief says it's not different, that Rule 11 is tantamount to a negligence standard. And it would be parsing hairs to try to say, well, Parsons was negligent, but its opinions at trial were found not to be wrongful. And moreover, the allegation here has to be viewed, Your Honors, in the context of the litigation, because the allegation here is you caused this litigation to happen. Okay, pretend they did. Was it wrongful litigation? No. We invite our citizens to come in off the street, not to have gun battles, but to resolve their issues in court. And the fact that one side may be wrong doesn't mean it's wrongful to come in and ask the court to rule on its opinions. So in comes the town, believe the festival if you want. They were, they were puppets of a water engineer. And they come in and advance these theories, which the judge, for the most part, doesn't address. But at the end, he says they weren't wrongful, that neither side did anything wrong. So I think here, forgetting whether there's a difference between negligence and Rule 11, that I don't believe there is if you look at our footnote. But in this context, it has to be viewed in that way. You have to, how could Parsons have been negligent, encouraging the town to go and test theories, which the judge found to be perfectly righteous? He agreed with some, he disagreed with others, but he didn't find that anybody was acting in bad faith or vexatiously or was going beyond what we're allowed to do in court, which is, advance the law and argue our side of the coin. So I think Judge King could have decided this issue on summary judgment on the issue of cause. He chose to go in the direction of proximate cause instead. I'm sorry, I said cause. He could have decided it on the basis of there was no breach of duty, that there was no wrongful act or negligence by Parsons.
But he didn't do that.
No, he didn't, but you can. The record supports equally that finding. I would submit supports the finding he made, which is there's no proximate connection between the wrongful advice. The only way we know who was going to win on the wastewater issue is what Judge Curry wrote. We can't go back and say, well, pretend he didn't reach that construction argument on Rule 5.23. Suppose he had to decide these other issues about engineering. Who would have won then? And that's essentially what we're trying to do here, is second guess. We're playing what ifs, okay? And that's the problem, again, with a unique kind of case like this. It isn't, over here was litigation I had to engage in. Doesn't matter what happened there. It was your fault because you did something wrong over here. Here, the town and Parsons are all the same. They all bring the same theories. The judge heard them all. He decided on one. He addressed the others only in passing, said they were academic.
Let me pose a different hypothetical. I'm understanding what you're saying, but I'm still struggling some. Couldn't in case number one, in the underlying case, the court say, and this maybe is hypothetical, but the court seems to me could come to the conclusion that the town was not wrongful for taking this position. Its interpretation of its ordinance was, I disagree, but not, it was nothing frivolous, and it wasn't wrongful for relying on the engineer. Irrespective of whether the engineer was dead wrong, that the town was totally reasonable to rely on the contractor it hired, that would allow the court in that case to reach the conclusion you just said. They weren't wrongful, but may get you a very different conclusion in this case, where the court could say, you know, the town didn't do anything wrong relying on an engineer, because that's why you hire an expert. But boy, the expert really messed this up. And therefore, I'm going to say, but for the expert messing it up, we never would have got here. The town would have gotten better advice, would not have brought the claim, and we're done.
Well, but that's not how it went down. If you read only one thing from the record in this case, I would have you read the festival's brief seeking fees against the town and against Scotty Krob and against its mayor, and pointing out, look what these engineers did, and naming Jim Miller. Look at the negligence by Jim Miller. This stuff, this is outrageous. We should have our fees. If you take that pleading that Judge Curry said, gee, I've thought about this, I sat through all, you know, motion denied, okay? You take that, they basically cut and pasted and brought the same action now against Parsons. It's the exact same claims against Parsons that are alleged here that were previously presented and rejected by.
But isn't the question, and I'm just sure. Obviously playing devil's advocate here, sure. Isn't the question different though? But in the prior case, the question was whether the town was wrongful. In this case, the question ultimately, assuming negligence and frivolous are, you know, interchangeable as you suggest, the question here is whether the engineer acted wrongfully. And I'm not seeing why the court necessarily decided whether Parsons was negligent in the first case. It wasn't an issue presented to the court in the first case.
But all in that brief that I'm describing, all of the allegations that are now brought against Parsons are initially brought against the town. The town should have known that 79,000 gallons was not a credible number. For that reason, we ought to have our fees. Judge Curry said no. And now they come in and say, well, Parsons should have known that 79,000 wasn't a credible number. Should we answer it differently now? If, again, what the town did was not wrongful, it tested theories, it had its experts, they had their experts, the experts disagreed, the judge said, experts from experts, this is a legal interpretation. Whatever either side did was not wrongful. How can their advisors have been wrongful in saying, you know, test this theory in court? And the judge said, there's nothing wrong with you. You put some of you win, some of you lose, but you haven't violated Rule 11. I don't know how you can come out differently on this issue without creating, you know, a dichotomy that can't be resolved. The engineering opinions or all discussed at length by both sides for 3 years and in that post-trial petition for fees. And Judge Curry says, you know, nobody's getting any fees here. I sat through this, I know what happened. Nobody's getting fees. Let me just make one other observation about the folks upstairs and how they clarified the wrong another doctrine to allow for, I think the expression was, uniquely traceable. If they can show some subcomponent of the underlying litigation uniquely traceable to Parsons. Three justices dissented and said this is an unwarranted expansion of the wrong of another doctrine. And the four justices who voted in favor all said, we're doing this with some trepidation, essentially. What they said is, if you can show that you have a segment that is uniquely traceable and that is segregable from the other issues, then maybe you can pursue a wrong with another. But they admonished that you cannot, to use their words, sift through past litigations and abstract small components of what should be understood as singular disputes in an attempt to recoup fees. So, accepting again, just for argument, because it's summary judgment, that the wastewater claim is segregable, we're now segregating that. Judge Curry said there's a lot of issues here on wastewater, but the one that matters, the one that's outcome determinative, is this interpretation of the ordinance. Now they say, well, forget about that. How about crop? What about that issue? Who wins on that one? And what about the 79,000 gallon? they're doing exactly what the court admonished that they can't do. We have gone beyond, you know, taking one issue, and we are segmenting it down to micro issues now, and suggesting, well, all right, you know, the town is to blame for the legal interpretation, which is what caused us to prevail, but let's speculate a little bit and see what might have happened if the court had decided path of least resistance and had gone on to decide these other issues. We can never know, and frankly, that's the thing the court was concerned about and didn't want to see happen. Judge, for any number of those reasons, I think you ought to sustain Judge King's order in this case.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Rice, you've got about 20 seconds.
Three quick points, Your Honor. There's already been a finding by Judge Curry and also by the Supreme Court that Parsons erred. There's no question about that. Point number two, Rule 11 is a different standard than what is at play in this case. And I believe if you read the briefs regarding the attorney fee issue, a large component of that was when the new expert came in, he was directed to follow the rule as he understood of Krupp, but to go back and redo the facts, and he found out that the facts that were relied upon by Parsons were wrong. And in addition, I concur with Judge Gabriel. It's clear that an attorney is allowed to rely upon his own expert witness. And if the expert's wrong, it's not the attorney's fault. That's why you get an expert.
Pardon me, Mr. Rice. You're out of time. Okay. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel, thank you very much for your arguments today. The case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course. Please, safe journey home.